Hey, and welcome back to the Cambridge American History Seminar podcast. I'm Caleb Woodall, a PhD student here at Cambridge, and today we welcome Dr. Noam Megha, Senior Lecturer in American History at Queen Mary University, London, and Fellow of the Institute of Advanced Studies in Paris. Dr. Megha's paper is titled Escaping the Periphery, Railroad Regulation as American Industrial Policy. I'm also joined by Shay Hendry, also a PhD student here at Cambridge. Cool. So thanks for joining us today, Noam. We'll start with the kind of obvious introductory question. Could you highlight the main argument of your text and its contribution to the broader historiography?
Okay. This is a paper about railroads, but I think more generally it's a paper about the transformation of American capitalism in the latter part of the 19th century. I would say there are maybe three main trajectories for American capitalism in the 19th century. The first is the growth of slavery, which we now know a great deal about. The territorial expansion of the United States over the course of the 19th century. And the third trajectory, which I think has received oddly, maybe the least amount of attention from Americanists over the last few years, is the emergence of the United States as a large industrial society. And that's a trajectory that I'm interested in exploring. My argument is that this was not a natural process or somehow a natural outgrowth of the other previous trajectories that I mentioned, but in fact was an odd and maybe in many ways unlikely development. Most countries in the New World, other places on the periphery of the world economy of the 19th century, when they emerge, they grow very rapidly. They export raw commodities in some ways very similarly to what the United States did in the early decades of the century. But most of them do not emerge also as urban industrial societies at the same time. In fact, they struggle to do that. So I grapple with that question. In this particular paper, I try to approach this question with a focus on a particular policy area, namely the regulation of railroad freight rates. And I argued that it was actually, in fact, a very interventionist, very proactive government policy that sought to very deliberately shape the emerging economic landscape of the United States. I used the concept of an American developmental state to say this is the explanatory actor. This is what set the U.S. apart from other countries on the global periphery. And we see through this case study of freight rate regulation, we can see how the American state was structured and why it was much better able to generate development, economic development, and industrialization than other similar peripheries. I compare the U.S. To Mexico to really bring into sharp relief what set the U.S. Apart from many of these other cases.
Cool. Yeah, so you speak a lot about the state, the developmental state. Could you maybe go a bit further and tell us what or who the state is in this telling?
Okay, I mean, first, maybe the concept of a developmental state is a concept that I'm bringing in from a lot of literature on that focuses on industrialization in the global South. So I import that concept into the context of the United States in the 19th century, which I think of as a type of developing country in that period. The state is, put it simply, it's the political institutions of the country. In the case of the United States, it's a federal state. This is how the political institutions are organized, and underlying those political institutions there's also a social structure and a particular balance of power between different constituencies that really gives the American state its own particular orientation.
Cool. Yeah, so I wanted to focus on the Munn v. Illinois example that you use in the text. You say that this ruling armed the states with wide-ranging authority to discipline capital. So what's the importance of this development in the broader history of state-capital relations in U.S. history?
Okay, so, I mean, the key lesson that I'm taking from this literature on the Global South is that for a peripheral economy to industrialize, to develop, the key agent is a developmental state. What makes the state developmental? It's precisely, as you said, the ability to discipline capital, meaning to deal with investors, with capitalists from a position of power, not from a position of deference. The Munn decision, which you mentioned, it's a famous decision that people have written about, it comes up in the Supreme Court, and it's really a question about the jurisdiction of various of the states to regulate railroads and other corporations. And the Supreme Court makes a striking decision, which I think is even more striking when you think about it in comparative terms. So if you think about the United States as a peripheral country, the fact that the Supreme Court is backing up the states in their efforts to discipline capital, to deal with capitalists from a position of power, becomes very very striking. Basically, it opens up an entire field for legislatures. I focus primarily on the Midwest to come up with various ways to regulate corporations, primarily railroads, which I think is very significant. People, primarily Bill Novak, have focused on the Munn decision. So Americanists, I think, have appreciated this as a pivotal decision. I think what I'm trying to add to the mix is to try to grapple with the economic implications of this decision. So this is not just about giving the state capacity. It's not just about getting capitalists to be better behaved, but it's actually, it opens up the way for much more far-reaching policies that are much more interventionist, and as I say, I call that a form of discipline. So I grapple much more than previous accounts with the relationship between this type of Supreme Court decision, legislation on the level of the states, and the economic trajectory of the American economy as a whole, and specifically the trajectory of the American Midwest.
Perfect, thank you. So I wanted to kind of bring the discussion into some more specifics as to how some of this regulation was implemented. And so I guess my first question would be, is there a difference in this kind of regulatory oversight between Western territories prior to statehood and afterwards in thinking about local economic development in places like the Midwest, or even getting into like Colorado in 76 versus Montana in 1890, or how that sort of played out?
I mean, I would put these cases on a continuum. I have a previous piece that focuses specifically on Western state constitutions and how they are written. And I would say the Midwest, you can definitely see these things happening on the continuum. They're part and parcel of the same process. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the Colorado state constitution, you see similar efforts by settlers as they write the Constitution to empower those states. Montana is another case, Wyoming, some of those other places, really looking to empower the state to regulate capital as it's moving in, allow the state, give it jurisdiction over labor relations, over taxation, over regulating corporations, which is a huge issue. So I would say this is typical of the American periphery more generally, probably more successful as an effort in the Midwestern states and in those far west states. Those far west states are the power of some of the extractive economies in those places, primarily mineral extraction, shape the political alignment they skew it in a particular way. But overall, I would say these battles are very typical for the American Midwest and West. They are part and parcel of the same kind of process of westward expansion.
Mm-hmm. And do we see differences in regulation based on type of cargo, I guess maybe is how I could say it, between like passenger trains or mineral transport, or how that breaks down?
I mean, well, passenger trains, that I would say that's a slightly separate issue. But in terms of freight rates and different classes of cargo, I think, you know, I would be reluctant to speak about that. I think part of the goal of this particular paper is to kind of open it up. The main comparison that I'm interested in is the U.S. versus Mexico in this particular piece. But I would say definitely I would welcome, maybe I would participate in follow-up studies that say, okay, now that we realize the significance of state regulation in those contexts and how they shape the economic trajectory of those places, maybe we can now move on to add some more nuance and to do some interstate comparisons, mm-hmm. to kind of see which states were more successful, which states were less successful, which railroad commissions were more antagonistic in their relations with railroads, more heavy-handed, which ones were less. There is a great variety of cases, and obviously in this one piece I wasn't able to get into all of those, mm-hmm. and to provide this kind of great heterogeneity. But this is something that would definitely be compatible with my analytical framework and how I'm thinking about it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to be honest, the key counter case that I would be most interested in looking at is the South, where a lot of my focus has been on the Midwest, where I think regulation was immensely successful politically and economically. I think the American South, the patterns are much more like other places in the global South, with very negative implications. So this would be another kind of counterexample that I would be interested in bringing in and trying to assess, mm-hmm. Comparatively.
So then I guess to pick up on the Mexico comparison, which I found quite interesting, and the kind of extractive industrial development we see happening there, I guess I'm wondering, even expanding outward, how important kind of the contiguous territory and the fact that we're talking about railroads is specific to this type of economic story, or if we see the transportation change, or we're talking about having to traverse oceans, kind of going beyond this specific land mass. Does that matter? I guess how specific is the relationship between the economic story and the specific technology that we're talking about in railroads?
Well, when we're talking about railroads, and when you talk about steam shipping, I think we can, in many ways, we can put these in a similar kind of bucket, mm-hmm. especially for this period. Basically, what we're talking about is cheap long haul transportation. So in this particular paper, I've focused specifically on Mexico. Mm-hmm. But the patterns that we see in Mexico that, as you mentioned, turn Mexico into a periphery of the United States, basically an exporter of raw materials that flow into the American economy, you see very similar patterns throughout Latin America. Mm-hmm. So you have railroad development, but it's very heavy on extractive sectors and on moving raw materials into basically bringing them into the world economy. Mm-hmm. So if they're not flowing directly into the United States, they're flowing into Western Europe through transatlantic shipping and ultimately generating a very similar type of dependency relationship between, mm-hmm. those Latin American countries and the industrial core of the world economy. So I think the Mexican case is probably very compatible, very similar in many ways to most cases in the global South in this period.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, then this maybe is just a bit of a wild card question. The answer will be a quick no. In thinking about railroads, most of my background has to do with understanding the relationship between railroads and timekeeping. And so I'm wondering, I guess, if that factors in at all in what we're seeing in terms of economic development.
I would say yes, to the extent that time is also connected with distance.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that Richard White has written about and other people have written about. I think I'm kind of, pushing this a little. I'm trying to be more discerning in how I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
The political conflict over who gets to be near, who gets to be far,
mm-hmm.
who gets to get to move it, move closer to the core, and who is drifting away, which is really a product of how long it takes to ship goods and how expensive it is.
Mm-hmm.
So these things are entangled, and this is what, you know, a lot of what the political kind of controversy is about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah, so before we head into the quickfire round later on, we've got a kind of question about comparisons. Are there any comparisons to be made between the transition from canals to railroads and then from railroads to aviation later, kind of regarding tech evolution and increasing reliance on these modes of transportation into everyday life?
Here I would say yes, a simple yes. I think one of the arguments of the paper is that there has been a sharp divide between accounts that we have on of canals and a transition to railroads, with the assumption that canals are, because they are, were built, they're public enterprises, they're built by the states. Railroads were overwhelmingly, they're subsidized by the public sector, but they were financed by, with private capital, they were private enterprises, that there's a sharp divide between them. But I argue that from a regulatory perspective, these two technologies are actually quite similar. They pose quite a similar type of challenge for regulators. And then I make some gestures about future technologies like air travel, that buses that also present similar type of regulatory challenges as we enter into the 20th century. I think overall, when you're talking about infrastructure, when you're talking about transportation, when you're talking about ultimately who gets to govern these gateways, these strategic arteries of commerce that really control the economy, I would tend to emphasize the continuity as a kind of ongoing problem in modern governance. So yes, there are definitely, you know, you can read this about the railroad, some of these precedents, and you can definitely think about the significance, the consequences, the lessons learned for the age of, say, Amazon, the internet, and the way that we think about regulating some of these monopolies and some of these companies that are really, they're private companies, but they have control over the strategic arteries of our economy. I think some of that 19th century thinking about it is actually immensely relevant in the contemporary context. I would definitely bring some of those lessons in as we think about these issues today.
Could you see a world, just building on that, could you see a world in which the state manages to achieve a similar level of regulation today as it did?
Yes, absolutely. And in a way, I would, you know, I want to be a good historian, but, you know, part of the subtext is that, yes, I'm in many ways advocating for that and advocating, kind of highlighting the very desirable outcomes of that. So I think that is implicit in the analysis. And you know, we can think about the goals, but also some of the methods here that I think what makes the paper interesting and part of this analysis of regulation is that it highlights what matters most. What matters, for example, what matters more in the context of railroads is less. Are they private or are they public? Are they privately owned or owned by the government? But more specifically, can the public impose its own priorities on these on this infrastructure, on how they are governed? So if you take some of the existing monopolies, they don't need to necessarily be nationalized or owned by a government entity, as long as the public is able to, as I mentioned earlier, discipline capital, so basically impose upon them constraints and priorities that are in line with our own expectations or hopes for greater equity, for a more balanced economy, for very, you know, environmental sustainability, those kinds of priorities. We can impose them on those corporations in a similar way that those 19th century regulators were quite adept at doing.
Cool. And then spinning up, this is kind of slightly unrelated to that, but in the paper you talk about railroad corporations using the language of kind of slavery to describe the position that they're placed in. Do these people see any irony as regards to how they treat their own workers?
No, clearly not. You know, I point to the work of Amy Drew Stanley. I mean, the passage that you're referring to is that when, you know, whenever regulators try to impose constraints on capitalists, capitalists to this day actually like to invoke this kind of dystopian language of this is communism, this is the end of civilization as we know it. And in the case of the 19th century, because slavery is still very much part of the conversation, they say this is enslavement because you are coercing us against our free will. We invested money freely, and now the government is telling us how to run our own property. So I don't, and you know, you know, we can read this and see the irony in it. But I think there, in many ways, it makes more sense to think of them as being dead serious about it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, as I said, Amy Drew Stanley's work is very useful in this sense, that when they think, what is the opposite of slavery for the capitalists, for business interests, it's precisely this emphasis of the absence of coercion, the notion that contract really represents the epitome of freedom. So from their perspective, it makes perfect sense to think of government regulation as a form of coercion that harks back to slavery.
Cool, thank you. So we'll kind of finish up with our usual quick fire round. I'll take one, you take the next, Shay. Cool. So what was the most important book you consulted when writing this piece?
Wow. There are many, many books that I consulted. You know, I would say, let me dodge a particular title and just say that the general work on development in the Global South, particularly the Asian cases, South Korea, China, Japan, Taiwan, Singapore, drawing inspiration from a theoretical framework that was developed studying those cases and trying to use that to understand the United States as a developing nation in the 19th century, I think really that is maybe the most important interpretive move that inspired this paper. So I would say that's the, and Alice Sampson's work in particular is perhaps most important in this context, particularly her argument that to develop, developing countries had to get prices wrong. So for me as an Americanist in a neoliberal context where the thrust is always we need to get prices right, that kind of provocation from her was incredibly fruitful and intellectually stimulating.
Yeah, that's an intriguing part of the article. So this is a fun one. Favorite Western?
Favorite Western?
Western.
Movie.
Movie, book, whatever.
Heaven's Gate. Not a very famous one because it's not really about, you know, this is one that I like because, you know, I wrote a book about Bostonian capitalists who go out west. This is a movie that starts at Harvard and... you know, focuses on capitalists in the West. It's not about Native Americans and the cowboys, mm-hmm. it's much more about class conflict and industrial capitalism on the frontier. Not surprisingly, it was not a huge hit in movie theaters because it was kind of at odds, I think, with the kind of mythology about the West. But that's the one that I would encourage people to check out.
Cool. So if you could host a historical music festival with artists from any period, who would your three headliners be?
Say that again, sorry.
If you could host a historical music festival with artists from any era, okay. who would your three headliners be?
When it comes to music, I'm very much a kind of a child of the 90s. So like the title, you know, Pearl Jam, probably, the Pixies, you know, Guns N' Roses, those would be, you know, maybe beforehand, Led Zeppelin. Those are the first, you know, Red Hot Chili Peppers, those would be the first kind of names that that come to mind. You know, I grew up in Israel, so I have the Israeli analogs of those as well in mind. But
amazing. So then last question, which kind of for you, what's next from your research? What's next for you?
Okay, well, I'm, you know, this is a maybe not a first, but actually, in fact, the second piece. The first piece was book project was a co-authored article that I wrote with my friend Stefan Link. Came out in Past and Present a few years back. This is the kind of second piece, and mostly I'm focusing on trying to conceptualize this as a larger book project that, you know, as you probably have already figured out, I'm less interested in the intricacies of railroad regulation as such. I'm much more interested in bringing this concept of a developmental state to how we think about American capitalism in the 19th century. So this is what I'm basically working on, how to implement that as a book project. So this is what I'm preoccupied with.
Great, very exciting.
Cool, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thanks, thank you so much for having me and for the great questions.